The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We have back on the table for discussion Senate File 2597, which is the teacher background checks relating to disciplinary action. And Senator Saltzman and Ms. Pontius and the members involved in this issue have gone to the back of the room, have had a long discussion, and now we think we have a resolution. So, Senator Saltzman.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. I'd like you to refer to the A5 amendment. I believe you have it.
Do all the members have the A5 amendment in front of you?
Sure do.
Senator Saltzman on the A5 amendment.
Yes. I'd like to thank you for sending us to the back of the room because I believe we have a better bill here. One of the concerns that you brought up was the asterisks or the flagging of names. And to ensure that the information is appropriate, we have taken that language out. And so this bill essentially requires school districts to call the board on every teacher who is being hired. And the board will then notify them if there is disciplinary action, and then will respond with appropriate information. The board did express some concerns about the effective date of July 1st of 2008, so I'd like to suggest that on a verbal amendment that that be changed to May 1st, 2009. And that will allow the board to begin to sort of ramp up for this, develop a system for that. So I believe that this has addressed your concerns.
So the effective date on lines 20 and 29?
Right, would be May 1st, 2009.
If it's okay with members, I think that we'll just incorporate that change into the A5 amendment. Senator Saltzman, would you or Ms. Pontius like to walk us through what the A5 amendment does? Just refresh our memory.
Would be able to do that,
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, basically, I think as Senator Saltzman said, instead of having this asterisk system that was in the original language the committee was looking at last week, the hiring authorities would just actually directly contact the board to find out whether there had been disciplinary action taken against a teacher based on sexual misconduct. And then if there was, then they would get access to the public data regarding that and use that to make their hiring decision. Otherwise, I think the other change also is there's Section 2. There's a provision under the current law which says that schools can hire pending completion of a background investigation. That's like the criminal history background investigation. And all this does is also make clear they can hire pending completion of the investigation of disciplinary actions, because that's a separate provision. Because that was one concern, that in terms of the timing of the school districts, if the board didn't respond to them in time or couldn't respond to them in time, if they sort of can make it clear that they can conditionally hire someone.
Any questions for Ms. Pontius? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, we also recently had a bill in here on background checks on coaches, and I take it that this would not affect that because it only applies to teachers, but how are the two similar or different on the background checks we do on coaches now as opposed to teachers?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel. Yeah, basically that bill just expanded sort of the universe of people that schools have to do background checks on. And that was just the criminal history background checks.
Right.
Whereas this is sort of a separate extra requirement that applies just to teachers.
The hiring of teachers?
The hiring of teachers, yes.
And Madam Chair and Senator Saltzman, it only applies to teachers, but there are other people who are employed by the school district, such as coaches, that do have interaction with some of the children. We're aware that this only applies to teachers and not anybody else. So at some point in the future, somebody going to say, well, why didn't you expand it to some of these other individuals?
Senator Saltzman.
Right. And to that point, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, because many of those are not licensed, that there is not a file on them, that there is not a board of janitors or a board of paraprofessionals, that it's my understanding that this information is specific to teachers. In the future, though, I did have a conversation with the School Board Association and several others before this about what other sorts of checks should we be doing on paraprofessionals that we're not doing now for future legislation, and what sort of information are we not obtaining, perhaps should be obtaining, that is available to us but that we're not checking on. But that is not addressed in this bill. This is specific to teachers. And that may be a future discussion for other employees, but at this point, those kind of files are not available, is my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
And that this also, I guess, is because this is the kind of action that does not show up on a criminal background check, but that school districts may want to know about if there was determination that, you know, there was inappropriate check, that there was sexual contact or else attempted inappropriate sexual contact, that there is documentation on that that is available to us to review.
Any further questions to Senator Saltzman and the A5 amendment?
Clarification, Madam Chair. The effective date, is that both on the same one on lines 20 and 29? Is it?
Yes, Senator Betzel.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Chair.
Senator Parasol.
Chair, as long as this this amendment is strictly for teachers, I'm looking at the very bottom paragraph. It says, relating to education, requiring boards to seek information from prospective employees. It doesn't, isn't very specific to teachers there, but I'm not sure if that needs to have any change either.
Senator Saltzman?
I will ask a council to maybe refer
Ms. Pines?
To that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, you could change it to teachers in the title to be more
and I would be open
precise
to that
in the description. Mm-hmm. So on line 33 and 34, mm-hmm. just say teachers instead of employees.
And without objections from the members, we will incorporate that change into the A5 amendment. Any further discussions on the A5 amendment? Senator Betzel moves the A5 amendment.
As modified.
As modified. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now on Senate File 2797, as amended, we took testimony the other day, but is there anybody here who would like to testify either for or against Senate File 2597 as amended? Are there any further discussions from the members? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2597 as amended be recommended to pass. And does this go to the floor?
Yes, sir.
It came from education. So it will be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevailed. Good work, Senator Saltzman.
Well, thank you for your input. It's a much better bill now, and I truly appreciate your input. Thank you.
Come back anytime.
Crazy.
Hold it under.
Something in statute that he finds the effect on the check is.
I'm going to do 3035 first.
Sir Moore, we've got two ITA bills on the agenda. Which one did you want to take up next?
Mr. Chair, I would like to start with Senate File 3035. We had started on that on Senate File 3035 last week, and we took testimony on the bill, and then we laid it on the table for further discussion in the interest of time. I just want to refresh everyone's memory. Senate File 3035 pertains to the use of non-conviction records by private employers and civil liability immunity. We had put an author's amendment onto the bill, and so to just do a technical change to the language of the bill.
We're operating off the A2 amendment, which was adopted at the last committee meeting. Senator Moore, did you say there's some?
Does everybody have the A2 amendment?
We should have the A2 amendment for you.
And so, members, I would like to take your input And Senate File 3035.
Okay. Well, why don't you give us a minute or two just to bring us back? Could you just again remind us what the
yes.
bill is?
Yes. So Mr. Chair, actually, I have Mr. Johnson here. I'm going to have him very quickly give us a reminder of the context for the bill, and then
Mr.
we
Johnson,
can have a discussion.
Again, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself again for the record.
My name is Tom Johnson. I'm with the Greg Plant Moody Law Firm. The last time I testified, I was president of the Council on Crime and Justice. The context for this bill is to seek to achieve a better balance in terms of creating opportunities for individuals who have a criminal record, starting with an arrest record, to gain meaningful employment. And it does that in two ways. In subdivision two of Section 3, it places the same restriction on private employers that currently exists for public employers in the state of Minnesota. And that restriction is one that says to a private employer, do not use an arrest record that has not resulted in a valid conviction in your decision to whether to hire a particular person. So this provides uniformity between private and public employers as it relates to the use of arrest records. That is the first provision. The second provision creates on a for those employers, private employers again, who voluntarily choose to follow certain procedures in their hiring practice, it creates a safe harbor for them from an action based on negligent hire theory that they might otherwise under current law be exposed to. Senator Olson and I were just talking about this issue. This is an issue where there's not extensive litigation. It's probably in fact and fair to say that there is relatively little litigation under the negligent hire theory. However, there is considerable concern regarding the exposure to liability that exists on the part of an employer when hiring someone with a criminal record. And so the impact of that potential exposure is quite sweeping and does result in individuals who have a conviction, in many cases convictions for minor offenses, in many cases that are old, very old, still being unable to obtain employment. And what this provision seeks to do is to allow that person a better opportunity by virtue of saying to an employer, if you follow these procedures that are provided for in Subdivision 3, you have basically an affirmative defense if you are sued to on the basis of negligently hiring someone with a criminal conviction.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Foley?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mao, and Mr. Johnson, perhaps, the total responsibility falls back on the employer? Is that what you're saying in this especially in regard to the non-conviction issues.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, with respect to the prohibition on the use of records, it's, I suppose, a responsibility that exists with employers. I think they'll take care of it relatively easily by simply not asking for those records when they are seeking or when either they're conducting or hiring out a background check. They will say, we only want conviction information, and will not then, in the course of getting their background checks done, receive information relating to arrests.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Foley.
And Mr. Johnson, I fail to see how you can do much in enforcing anything like this, and perhaps you can enlighten me as to what you're proposing in that area.
Mr. Johnson? enforcement? There is a remedy in
Senator Foley, Subdivision 4 does provide a remedy. It's not an overly severe remedy. It's a liquidated damages provision of $1,000 for violation of the prohibition on using arrest records, or actual damages if you could establish that they were larger. This would be up to the job applicant who suspects that her or his arrest record had been used by the employer, prospective employer, in making the decision relative to that person's that person being hired. They would have to initiate a lawsuit in order to determine that. So it's not an easy remedy for sure. It's not one that would I would anticipate would be sought often. But I think that it would. If you had an employer, for example, that was just had a blanket prohibition on hiring people with arrest, that could easily give rise to a lawsuit where it was brought on the number of on the basis of a number of job applicants. Certainly, the hope here would be that employers, it's a simple thing for them to do. There are a number of employers in the state of Minnesota, and we had a letter last time from the 3M Corporation that said this is their policy now, not to use arrest records in their hiring decisions. We know that exists among a number of the larger employers anyway that do business in other states. So we would anticipate that they would just incorporate it into their hiring practices and that ideally that would be the end of the matter.
Sir Foley?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, I'm somewhat skeptical as to that ever being followed. Is there a civil penalty under the remedies, or is there a civil penalty conduct? Because I noticed that you do have a criminal penalty as a gross misdemeanor, at least.
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, the $1,000 penalty is a civil penalty, and that would be the minimum that a person would be entitled to if they could show that their arrest record had been a part of the hiring decision. If they could prove actual damages in a civil lawsuit, then they would be entitled to those actual damages.
So presumably, if somebody wanted to go to conciliation court, they'd only get $750. That's the cap, but they could $7,500. Also, they could go to conciliation court to do it that way. Okay, $7,500. That's right. Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I would just like to apologize to Senator Moi for not having had a chance to discuss this with her before. Immediately after this was first discussed in our last hearing, I had mentioned my concerns to a lady who testified, and I had understood she was going to get in touch with me. I haven't heard from her, and I haven't independently followed up on this either. So I'd just like to apologize for that. But I have been just briefly discussing with Mr. Johnson some of my concerns. And first, I would challenge the statement that he made about the fact that this hardly ever comes up. There's a whole body of law that relates to negligent hiring, and I'm very uncomfortable passing what I would consider a very sweeping change to that body of law without anyone here to speak on the other side. Granted, they, I assume, have had notice. I don't know why we don't have somebody here from the Association for Justice, but I can think of so many cases where, on the one hand, we're listening to other bills that are concerned, where we're putting in changes to protect our kids from predatory behavior. And I could give you many examples where I'm especially concerned about people who are in relationships with people who are more vulnerable. I can think of past cases I've handled where a police officer we brought a civil case because he took advantage of a young minor girl. where we have cases where we have counselors or ministers in relationship with people they're counseling, our parishioners. We have cases of medical people. I've handled medical people and their treatment of patients. I mean, there are many situations where we have a whole body of law for dealing with people in when they have are in a position to take advantage of more vulnerable people in their charge. And now what we're saying is that unless you could, you're not going to be able as a, are not going to be able as an employer to, you're going to be immune from liability, or you're not going to be allowed to consider a non-conviction criminal record of that type of behavior. And so I'm assuming that that also might mean, say, a civil complaint or a civil action where that person might have been found civilly liable for that type of behavior and you won't be able to consider it. Or you are going to have a situation where even when the person has a criminal conviction for that type of behavior, if it doesn't directly relate to the position of employment being sought, you can't consider it. Now, it might be that it's a totally different type of job, but not someone you would want in that type of a with that kind of a predatory record being allowed to have access to people who are more vulnerable. So I would submit that this is a very sweeping change in our law with respect to those kinds of issues. And I would have, and I certainly don't support it, especially without input from people who represent the victims of these kinds of crimes. And I understand from Mr. Johnson that he hasn't discussed this with the Association for Justice or any of those types of people. And then I would also, I also have some problems from a legal standpoint. And I think Mr. Johnson would concede that although you say immunity from civil liability, and that sounds pretty blanket, but then it switches to say that you still have to decide whether you're reasonably determining these things. And so it that kind of sounds like a negligence standard. And the law related to negligent hiring or retention in the first place is a negligence standard. There's a whole body of law around that. Now we're kind of substituting something else, but it's still reasonably determined. And I'm not sure what the courts will do with that, but you know that definitely is a change. So, again, I apologize for not having had the chance to talk about this sooner, but I'm very uncomfortable with this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, is the entire bill repugnant to you, or just the section on immunity from civil liability?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Johnson means well, and I think there are certainly situations where we want to encourage people to be able to be hired because, as he said, there are some situations where there are minor offenses, and we don't want to prevent those people from being able to be adequately employed, and certain types of offenses even that would make sense to work in that direction of encouraging their employment. But this is an extremely broad bill that does not accept those situations that I was describing. And so what I would say is that I'm not, I would like to, you know, I would like to have the chance to try to narrow the bill to those situations that Mr. Johnson is really the most concerned about or trying to achieve, the goal he's trying to achieve. But I'm not prepared to offer an amendment that would do that at this point.
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to take more questions from members of the committee. This is the, and I'm willing to take input on the bill. This issue is very important to me. And as you know, that for the committee, we've done a lot of work with collateral sanctions. This is one of the efforts we're trying to put in place to try to address the collateral sanctions issues that we have. And so I would be glad to continue to work with the committee members as we move forward. But, I feel like I can't continue to lay the bill over in perpetuity.
Well, this bill still has another stop to go to the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, but, of course, some of the issues that
Senator Olson was mentioning are in the purview of this committee. I mean, immunity is our issue, not some other committee. I mean, they can talk about it, but we're the ones that delve into the most. First of all, are there any other comments or questions by members of the committee? And is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on Senate File 3035? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Moi or Mr. Johnson, does this apply to every job in the state of Minnesota outside of the exceptions that are listed on the on page 2 and 1?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. Subdivision 2 has a parallel, as I said, in Chapter 364, which applies to public employers. So the provision of Subdivision 2 is already existing law for public employers, and it would apply then to all private employers, but accepts out those offenses or those positions, rather, that are subject to a statutory background check, for example. So positions that involve working with a vulnerable population, whether they're old or young or, you know, the long list of provisions that or positions that go through the process for through the in the Department of Human Services would be exempted from Subdivision 2. With respect to Subdivision 3 and immunity, any position that involves a licensing process, obviously the person has to go through the that process in order to have a license to be in have present fitness to perform the duties that is referenced in Subdivision 3. So that's the way in which it deals with what
Chair,
positions are covered and not.
My questions were more focused on private employment, not public. One of the obvious ones that certainly has attracted a lot of public discussion over the years is people in the housing industry, perhaps a landlord, hirings of managers for apartment complexes, people that have keys to apartments and people's dwellings. Is that specifically addressed in this bill? They're employees.
Senator Betzel, Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer, the language of Subdivision 2 very specifically limits this to occupations that are not currently where there is not currently a background check in play. So in those circumstances that you've talked about, we work with Malta Housing Association. I mean, they would be excluded from coverage here because people like teachers and landlord situation, those individuals under a separate part of the statute are required by law to have background checks. So in those instances, this is not trying to cover that. This is trying to cover the sort of the day-to-day private employment and public employment situation where there is not a separate statutory requirement for a background check to be done on those individuals.
Sir Lover. Mr. Chair, I can think of one instance, and I'm not sure if this would cover it or not. a school, or not a school, I guess it was a school. A school owned a pool. The school district hired for the summer a swimming instructor who later was accused of groping his swimming students under the water surface. A lot of the children were giving testimony that that's what had happened. The prosecuting authorities never... They arrested the person but did not have enough information to adequately perform a full prosecution of the case. Now, does that individual fit and is or can an employer continue to hire them without having a sufficient investigation, or can they legitimately say, no, we don't want to hire you because there's no conviction.
Actually, Senate Counsel would have the answer to that one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, if the school was the hiring authority, this law does not apply to them. However, well, they probably come, well, depending on what happens with, I think, with Senator Pappas's bill that expanded the people who are subject to background investigations, schools do those by statute right now. There's a separate provision in Chapter 364 that applies to all public employers. So, and that's what you see on in the definition on page 2, lines 32 to 34, where it defines private employers, and it doesn't include those that are governed by 364.01. Those statutes already apply to public employers. But again, there's a number of exceptions in there, you know, like for human services, licensing, teachers. So that doesn't cover all public employment, but some.
Any other questions or any further discussion? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused on this point that we're talking about, so I just want to make sure I understand it, because on 2.32, we're saying does not include the private employer, and then it goes on, does not include state or a political subdivision of the state governed by these sections. And then you talk about the licensing and so forth, you know, things that don't, it doesn't apply to, are people who require licenses and so forth. But what about all the people who are in the private sector that require licenses or require, I mean, I'm assuming the immunity from civil liability and use of non-conviction records is going to apply to all of those types of occupations who are in the private sector, because they're not, this exemption to say it doesn't apply are only for state or political subdivision employers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, if the individuals in those private professions require a license, and as part of their licensing, if there's a background check required, then there's already a background check process that's required for them. So obviously the employer who require, I mean, who is statutorily permitted to do that background check can use that information for that profession, because by statute we're allowing them to do the background check. So this, again, this doesn't cover those professions where already in law we're requiring people to go through, get subjected through a background check.
And Ms. Pines may have additional information on that too.
Madam Chair, yeah, this is Senator Moss said, or Mr. Chair.
How you doing?
As Senator Moss said, because a lot of the human services licensing provisions are specific, and those are also not covered by the current law that limits what public employers can do, and they also wouldn't be covered by this provision because background investigations are required by law. But to the extent they weren't required by law and it was private employers, then the new requirements of the bill would kick in.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, it seems to me that it would be extremely helpful to have somebody from the industry or business to, I know you got a letter directed to Tom Johnson, but we really should know what the feelings are of the employers that are going to use this thing and see whether we have got something that will work or work partly or not at all.
Well, Senator Foley, as I indicated, if this bill passes from this committee, it would be referred to the Committee on Business, Job, Industry, and Jobs. And certainly, you know, in that particular committee, they would be looking at that particular aspect. I mean, we can do it as well here, too. They certainly would look at that aspect in that the next committee. Obviously, our committee jurisdiction is on the immunity sections and some of the background checks. And stuff. It's appropriate in either committee, but the next committee would have, you know, more jurisdiction over that particular question. But I don't know that there's anybody here. I did ask if there's anybody aware who wants to testify, and I don't see anybody coming up.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, this is the second time that this bill has been on the agenda. And other than the letter from 3M indicating support for this bill, I have not been contacted by any other organizations or individuals. As this bill moves forward, I would welcome an opportunity to engage anybody who has either support or concern for the bill. But just in the interest of time, I'd like to keep the bill moving.
Sure.
And should the bill be so repugnant to individuals, again, I mean, it's my bill, and I certainly don't want to put bad public policy out there if people are concerned about that. So I'm definitely willing to work with individuals on it. But we've had to postpone the bill twice, and in that time, people have known that it's been on the agenda, and no one's come forward to contact us. So, Mr. Chair, if there are no further questions, I would like to move the bill with the caveat that I continue to work with Senator Olson or, you know, individuals who may have concern about it. If at the end of the day it is something that is not workable, you know, as the chair of this committee, I certainly don't want to put things out there that are not the best product of what we do. So I like to keep the bill moving, keeping in mind that I like to be able to continue to work with people.
And members, keep in mind, for those who were not here at the start of the discussion, we adopted the A2 amendment at our previous committee hearing. So that's the amended bill that we were looking at. Senator Moore moves that Senate File 3035, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs. Is there a discussion? Senator Limerick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Mwat, was there any discussion that you've heard from the business community, whether the Chamber of Commerce or National Federation of Independent Business, for or against this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, the provision of the immunity provision was to create some comfort for those private employers, and really as led by the example of 3M as one of our major corporations who are saying we're already doing this anyways all across the U.S. But I think that to be fair, if we're going to ask private employers, you know, to think about not taking into consideration the conviction records, that we should give them an opportunity to have some immunity from liability if they're doing the best that they can. And so the provision that Senator Olson has problems with, it was the provision that I put in place to try to balance the policy here for the employers as well as for those of us who want to move forward on collateral sanctions as a policy area.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, I would tend to think that most businesses who want to get out of liability so they don't have to address arrest records or conviction records is probably something they don't want to be on record for. And if they remain quiet, this may pass, and they can get their immunity, and then they don't have to have that PR, that little PR problem that they're going to have to address. And I guess that's maybe that shifts to the PR question I might have sometime in the future trying to explain this in the event that there may be an unintended consequence, and everyone will point back to the legislature and say, you did what? And I don't know, maybe there's a right to know here question that has to be addressed, and I don't know if we've had that full discussion.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and members, I support the immunity clause of this bill. It's an absolute necessity in Minnesota to have employer immunity for making the decisions that they make if they hire someone with a criminal background, as long as the criminal background isn't applicable to their current duties. But I think that Subdivision 2 may go too far in Subdivision 4 to say that a private employer may not use that information or must not. I'm not really sure what the distinction is between a shall and a must, but shall not or must not says that they may not use information that is available to them. And if they do use information that might be out in the public, they can face a cause of action. And that could lead to the strange result that you've got all employees who have a criminal background now suing because they had a criminal background and the assumption that it was used in the hiring decision. How would the employer prove that it wasn't used in the hiring decision? And so I think maybe this bill goes too far in providing that. I understand the purpose of the bill. I understand that we should be granting immunity from civil liability for these hiring decisions, but I don't think that we should tell employers what information they cannot use and there is a penalty for violation of that. I think that goes a little too far, and so I can't support the bill. I would definitely support it if it were just Subdivision 3 here, but I think 2 and 4 go just too far.
Mr. Chairman.
And, Senator Roman, just a technical point, must not and shall not mean the same thing. It's just for consistency purpose in statutes. They usually use shall not. Senator Shy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did miss some of the original testimony because I was upstairs chairing a meeting where I'm needed shortly, but I know this is an important issue, and it's been we've discussed it a number of times in various permutations, if you will, in various bills. But I understand that it is a real balancing act, and I think that's really important. I think you've done a good job of balancing, and I intend to support the bill. I want to just have you reiterate, I'm sure, I say reiterate, assuming that you talked about the kinds of cases where we do require the criminal background check. So I'm assuming, I should probably just listen, but I'm going to make the assumption that we aren't talking about, sexual predators or vulnerable, being exposed to people who are vulnerable, et cetera, in the workplace, if you could just expand.
Senator Scheid, right now, anybody who has to be subjected to a background check, any job, so Health and Human Services, licensing, any kind of licensing type of job, teachers, any of the multitude of the things that we've talked about here involving criminal background check, all of that stuff, those employers who are by statute are required to do that background check are not covered by this.
This covers
the instances where that absolute requirement for a background check is not there. I think that if you look at the universe of how far we've gone in requiring a criminal background check virtually for almost every job out there, and if we would just, if you all have a chance, please take a look at the collateral sanctions report, and you will see how many jobs right now, whether it is through housing or employment, we're requiring a criminal background check. And by the way, I'm not even there yet, but I'm going to get there. If this bill has already have members of this committee hesitant about that, wait until we actually get to that discussion, because I just think that there's just some gross injustices to what we're forcing people to do, forcing entire categories of people from not being employed. And this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we're trying to do in addressing collateral sanctions. So, I think it's very limited, and it gives the businesses an opportunity to know that in addressing collateral sanctions issues, I am not somebody who is blindly coming into this issue and being unfair, but I think we're trying to be balanced about the approach, take into consideration people's opportunities for a future, for a job, and yet take into consideration the needs of the employers who are engaging these people in employment. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion.
Well, Senator Russell.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask Senator Moy or else counsel, regardless of who wants to answer it, are there absolute criminal background checks done on, for instance, people who do care of not just vulnerable adults, but vulnerable patients of any age? And are they mandatory already?
Yes.
Sorry to have to ask this question, but I haven't been in this committee long enough to know that. Okay, because I think that there are those contingent kinds of situations are the most precocious in that, I want to make sure that that's covered somewhere.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know that Senator Ma wants to move her bill, so I don't want to belabor this point, but I would just say that, the employer is in the best position, in my opinion, to know if it's the type of job that's going to give that person some type of an advantage over vulnerable people. And there are many, many, many jobs out there. And there will always be new jobs where we don't require a background check. I know we require them in lots of cases. And maybe in some situations we're overdoing it in some cases. And I'm certainly open-minded to looking at that. I'm more concerned about, however, the types of offenses that we're excluding and the fact that we're excluding all all potential offenses and situations where I can specifically think of where maybe someone's license wasn't affected, maybe the system didn't work the way it was supposed to in terms of preventing that or affecting that person's licensure, and yet the later employer did know about the conduct, whether it arose. I mean, we've all seen what's happened with some employers that have hidden information that never was reported, and so it never affected someone's license. And yet we're saying that if they're passed along to another employer or they're put into a similar position and that new employer has knowledge of that underlying type of conduct, we're giving them immunity, potentially.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know that we were ever going to be able to address all of those circumstances that you've raised, despite the multitude of background check requirements and background check statutes that we've already put in place. I mean, just look at all the different careers and professions that we've instituted background check requirements for, and we still cannot catch everyone. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think that the underlying issue that you have is the larger question of whether or not we're requiring enough background checks for the jobs that pertains to the vulnerable people that you're concerned about. I think that this is just given an opportunity for some employers who are looking to employ somebody who might have an arrest record that does not necessarily pertain to the specific job that they're working in, to give them an opportunity for employment and giving the employer some peace of mind to say, I've done my best, and for the purposes of what I need this person to do, I can ignore the arrest records that are out there in this individual. In my parallel universe, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, an awful lot of people get picked up and brought in for questions. It is not unusual that we have people in our community who get stopped periodically just because they're standing in the corner waiting for the bus and get brought in for questions. And so there are lots of people who are honorable people, but by circumstances, they often just get picked up and brought in for questioning because they happen to look like somebody who may have done something or allegedly done something. And I think that what this bill is trying to do is to give those individuals who are in those circumstances an opportunity to at least be able to say that a certain employer could go ahead and hire that individual after they've done the due diligence that they need to.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, and I understand that's your concern, and I commend that concern, and certainly wouldn't argue with it, I guess. But I'm not advocating for more background checks. I guess all I'm saying is that in situations where a person actually knows, I think what your concern is that there are people avoiding hiring people, not because they know that they're going to be a problem or have reason to know that they're going to be a problem, but just because they're afraid of civil liability, and so it's kind of a chilling effect on hiring people. And I understand that we want people to be able to get jobs who are not going to be a threat. My concern, though, is that when you grant immunity, you change change from the standard we've had about whether there's negligence whether this person is negligence in determining whether this person is appropriate for the job, and you absolve them of that responsibility of making that determination in situations where some people truly are going to be in jobs where they could potentially be a danger, and the employer should have known that. And this seems to say that simply because they're putting them in a situation where what they're doing doesn't directly relate to the new position they'd be putting them in, that they have that type of civil immunity. And that's what concerns me.
Further discussion on the motion. Senator Foley?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, members, I guess I have some reservations about the whole thing, but I'm pleased that you are doing this, Senator Mahal. serious problem dealing with arrests and use of arrest data and so forth. And all of us would probably be very surprised if they looked at their files and determined what things say. And in response to the Senator Mollis' comments on collateral sanctions and so forth, it's really a tough situation. And if you look at people that have been stopped, delayed, or been arrested, include such people as Justice Ellen Page, the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota. There are just all kinds of people that we all know and believe are honest, upstanding people, with the exception of you, Mr. Johnson. But this is an important area, and I fully support moving this bill forward.
Further discussion. Senator Moore renews her motion that Senate File 3035 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Moore, when I chaired this committee, I didn't like bringing bills before this committee either, so.
You know, when I started the committee last year, I asked whether or not this committee was willing to kill bills. And my sense was that most members were hesitant to do that, except I think on my bills, Mr. Chair.
No. As I
on
said,
my bills.
People are concerned about bringing their bills before this committee, and rightly so, and we want them to.
No, I would like to think, Mr. Chair, that it is because I am so far out front and willing to take risks and really push the envelope on major policy considerations.
You're out there.
Just my interpretation.
Keep charging off. You know, we're behind you somewhere.
Well, Mr. Okay. Chair, speaking of being out there, thank you.
This is Senate File 2644.
Senate File 2644 is, I believe, that another area that this committee should have great appreciation for, Mr. Chair. Throughout the past decade, there has been a sentiment that users of the civil and criminal justice system should help pay for them. In other words, the court system should resemble more of a fee-for-service funding model than a general fund appropriation model. And this is particularly true of the criminal justice system, where the users are criminals, and the passage of onerous fees and surcharges can be justified as both punishment and reimbursement. An example is the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, which receives 39% of the first $25 of the criminal and traffic surcharge. Of course, the criminal justice system, police, courts, and corrections is also is so large that fees and surcharges can recoup only a small fraction of the total cost of the system. In any case, unless a fee or surcharge is statutorily dedicated, it flows to the general fund, not to a particular agency or service, leaving law enforcement, the courts, and corrections to go through the general fund appropriation process. So almost all fee and surcharge increases since 2003 have been deposited in the general fund in this manner. In 2003, Mr. Chair and members, the state was facing a $4.2 billion budget deficit. In response, all state agencies were forced to cut their budgets, and the legislature searched for ways to raise revenue. Because of the number of fees and surcharges already present in the criminal and civil justice systems, the legislature created only one new fee and one new surcharge, but enhanced a dozen others. Raising existing fees and surcharges had the added advantage that collection histories existed and a rough but approximate estimate of anticipated revenues could be made. The 2003 crime bill raised judicial fees and surcharges by $80.6 million for the biennium, all of which was deposited into the general fund.
Simultaneously, criminal justice-based funding for the biennium was cut by $98.2 million, which included a $14.8 million cut to the courts, a $25.7 million cut to the Department of Public Safety, and a $57.7 million cut to the Department of Corrections. The 2005 crime bill raised an additional $16.3 million in civil and criminal fees and surcharges, which were deposited in the general fund. Of course, these general fund cuts and fee and surcharge increases became part of the state's budget base, where they remain today. A list of increased fees and surcharges are in the handout that I hope is in your file in front of you. In addition to the judicial fees and surcharges in the chart that you have in front of you, the legislature increased the DWI driver's license reinstatement surcharge from $40 to $145, effective July 1 of 2002, and then from $145 to $430, effective July 1, 2003. There are approximately 29,000 DWI license reinstatements each year. The increase from $4 to $430 brings in approximately $11.3 million annually. By increasing fees and surcharges, the legislature solved the short-term budget problem, but created some unintended long-term consequences. Many argue that the increase in civil court fees has been so steep that it has essentially denied court access to lower-income citizens. Although this claim is anecdotal, it certainly seems plausible, as filing fees are collected prior to court action and cannot be waived. The 2003 crime bill raised 12 civil court fees, collecting an additional $43.3 million over the biennium. Another unintended consequence of the increase in criminal and traffic surcharge is the proliferation of administrative fine schedules by local units of government. And may I remind the members that that bill failed in this committee. Many cities and counties are issuing local ordinances and ordinance fines in lieu of uniform traffic citations. By doing so, they are retaining the entire fine locally. Currently, the state received two-thirds of the fine, and the state surcharges of $72 goes uncollected. The increased local fine collection is not the only reason local governments are pursuing administrative fines. Many officials feel that the $72 surcharge on a traffic ticket is simply inequitable. This anecdotal evidence implies that at some point, the increased traffic surcharge is counterproductive. Finally, there is the problem of noncompliance. This is particularly true of the DWI driver's license and reinstatement surcharge, which has increased again from $40 in 2002 to $430 today. When added to the $250 reinstatement fee, the total cost to regain one's license is $680. Many offenders simply prefer to drive without a license, which in turn creates more problems down the road, which results in further noncompliance. There are thousands of outstanding warrants for driving without a license. So, members, this bill is kind of on the edge. And what this bill basically does is it's asking us as a policy committee to take a real look at the policy implications and policy consequences for the dramatic increases we've imposed on all citizens of Minnesotans by making them pay more to access their judiciary. I personally feel that a judiciary that is too expensive is a judiciary that is inaccessible, and the judiciary that's inaccessible is justice that is denied to people who are guaranteed justice in our judiciary system. So Senate File 2644, members, is to roll back all the fees and surcharges that were imposed post-2003 back to the pre-2003 level, keeping in place only a new surcharge, which is the $40 addition that we created to raise more money for the traumatic brain injury program. And that is the bill, members.
Any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Moi, when we cut fees or revenue sources, could this be creating a hole in someone's budget, and how would we fill that?
Well, Senator Limmer, we're a policy committee, and yes, it will create a hole,
and I'm sure it would create a very big hole. And if you look at the chart in front of you, the total on the bottom of that chart, I don't have the most updated chart in front of me, but it will create quite a big hole. I believe it will create a maybe Mr. Turner can give me the most updated number.
Mr.
Is
Chair.
It the 107, Mr. Turner?
Turner.
It will create a $107.6 million hole in the budget.
Okay. Apparently that's correct. By the way, there's a technical amendment that did you want to offer?
Oh, yes. We should go ahead and offer
okay.
the technical amendment.
We'll
I apologize.
Distributed. This is a policy committee. Of course, we are sometimes advised that policy committees should be aware of the fiscal issues, too. I mean, I've sat on policy committees where we just shovel any number of bills off to the budget division to let them figure it out. But at some point, we all have to vote on it. Sam Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Anybody who wants to respond to this, I've been hearing from some sheriffs recently that they are looking to establish new drivers programs, you know, in their counties. And because sometimes they have state highways and national highways going through, and the troopers can't always be available to patrol them, so it does fall to the sheriff thereafter, and they are looking for influx of dollars in order to establish that, and I don't know how that will probably be. If he wants to do it badly enough, then the county board might establish some property tax increases to do that, or some other kind of tax or for surcharges. Of course, we've been talking about the gas tax, you know, by individual counties, and I suppose they could do almost anything else. But I'm assuming that this will not be taken very nicely by the County Sheriff's Association, but I'm not certain.
Well, and this, if this bill proceeds from here, the Committee on Transportation does need to see it. They, of course, have the purview over the both policy and budget within that committee, and then they would be looking at the public safety aspects of that. Ultimately, if the bill does proceed along the way, it would have to go to the Finance Committee, where it could be looked at in the Judiciary Budget Division, possibly Public Safety, a number of other areas would have to look at this at some point. But the next stop after here would be Transportation Committee. Anybody else? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moe. It's really hard to divorce the policy from the money here because it will have such a dramatic impact on the general fund and about the funding that's available to law enforcement. And I've heard over and over again when I introduce a bill, how are you going to pay for that? And I'm just not sure that we have sufficient of an answer to say that we can support the policy because I find it very hard to distinguish the two. And I understand what you're trying to accomplish. It should be less expensive. I think that was the whole theory behind the administrative penalty order and some other things that we've seen here, that it shouldn't be so expensive. And I don't disagree with you, but I also think we need to say, where is that money going to come from? And to just shift it to the general fund, the impact of the general fund is probably not a good policy decision. So,
well, Mr. Chair and members, as a policy committee who cares very much about public policy, and really, I mean, we have jurisdiction over how, from a policy standpoint, how we help to craft and regulate the judiciary in a way that makes it accessible to our citizens. And I think that as a committee, we should have a thorough discussion about whether or not these excessive fees that doesn't even come back to support the institutions that work to provide, you know, our justice system for our citizens. These excessive fees doesn't even come back to support those institutions adequately. And I think we should have that conversation. Yes, I understand very clearly that it creates a hole, but isn't it all the more dramatic that we're taking from people who are the most vulnerable, who ought to, I mean, we have guaranteed our citizens that they would have access to a judiciary, to a justice system. We've taken care as part of our Constitution to ensure that. And yet, we've imposed such onerous fees that we've virtually eliminated that justice system from their grasp unless they have the funds and the finances to do it. And I think as a policy committee, we really, it's incumbent upon us to send that message to say, you know, if the rest of the budget has to be taken care of, then find the resources to deal with the rest of the other budget. But not at the cost. Not at the cost of taking away access to the judiciary.
And it does raise an interesting question, Samuel, because you know we raise the fees in the court system to pay for other areas of the budget. If the fees were kept within the court system, we would still have some of the inequities and problems that you raised, but then the court system would be adequately funded. And I don't know where we'd go, but that's not the proposal we have before us, but it does raise an interesting question. Mr. Backus pointed, we can discuss the A1 amendment, and apparently it needs to be adopted in light of the transportation bill that's now become law. Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. It's basically a technical amendment. Section 1 of the bill amends the DWI license reinstatement fee provision, and that was amended in the transportation bill to have an installment plan. So by deleting the original Section 1 and replacing it with the new Section 1 as amended by the transportation bill, it still makes the exact same changes as in the original bill. So it's technical in the sense we have to call up the new provision.
Okay. So was the A1 amendment. Is there a discussion on the A1 amendment? I guess we could treat it as an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion prevails. Senator Periso had us leave to check in and make a quorum on the on some other committees, so she did ask to hold any vote until she got back. Is there further discussion on Senate File 2644? Okay. If you don't mind, we'll just wait, and we can sit here and wait for a few minutes, but she just told me that she's just going to go make quorum and come back. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Sir Foley.
Editorial comment. I look at this as a function of dealing with this type of legislation in this committee, but if this passes and comes through, I certainly would ask that the committee or the bill would be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Foley would have to. It's going to go to the Transportation Committee next because of the DUI provisions, and if it passes out of there, it would have to go to the Finance Committee. And once it's in Finance Committee, of course, it can move around within various budget divisions because they're all part of the Finance Committee. So the Judiciary Budget Division could look at it, as well as Public Safety and anybody else, including Transportation Budget, if they wanted to look at it again. Once it's within Finance Committee, so yes, I think it would certainly have to go in there. It couldn't go straight to the floor, obviously not. Anybody else want to testify? Yeah, we do have other folks who wish to be heard on it. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. If there's anybody else who's here who wants to testify, please come forward so we can stand record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We're in support of this bill with the proviso that, of course, that the legislature finds the accompanying monies to backfill the budget hole so there's not a negative impact on local units of government or the operation of local units of government. One of the arguments in that, on behalf of admin fines that we've been talking about for many years is the fact that the fines are onerous, that the surcharges make them doubly so. And we think that removing the surcharges would remove that argument. And secondly, I wanted to point out that even though that we're scheduled to receive 39% of all traffic and criminal surcharges generated by the law, we only receive about 22% for police funding. For police training, we've raided that fund to backfill the budget for much too long. And I would not only urge that you do this, but that you urge your colleagues to properly and adequately fund police training for local units of government, and that in fact it also bleeds over into the local government aid issue, where some of the administrative fine money is untrackable. That's one of the reasons that we oppose it, and we suspect it's being used for the operation of local units of government rather than what it was originally intended for, which was for the original surcharge that existed, which I had my fingers on many years ago, was for police training, a dedicated source of funding for that.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Franklin. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, also speaking on behalf this morning of the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association. And I will, Bill has already articulated the same concerns that we have. While we maybe share a difference of opinion on the administrative fine issue, I would just like to point out for the committee the issues that are associated with the revenue costs for the counties specifically as it relates to the surcharges that we're talking about. What we have seen is an insurgent increase of unpaid fines. When somebody does receive a citation, does not have the money, that simply goes into an unpaid fine, which translates into a warrant, which translates into increased arrest and or incarceration into the jail and or into overburdening of the criminal justice system. But it also translates to, while the father or mother is in the jail, they do not have the aid or the assistance to work. They are then collecting food stamps, welfare, or other assistance in order to help support and pay for their family or don't pay for their family needs, which also passes those costs on to the county in a number of different ways. So the surcharge fee has costs, especially to the county, that goes just beyond this. Obviously, there's a $100 million hole in the state budget that we would hope needs to be filled, because, again, if that's not filled, these costs, again, continue to be passed on to the county, as I've already articulated. So those are our concerns as it relates to the impact of the fee currently on the county. If that could be reduced and filled with general fund money, we believe that this would help all the way around. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, also, if I could, this is viewed by our association, certainly the representing line police officers, as the most regressive form of taxation you can make. It has no balance or effect on how much you make or what you are able to pay. It's simply a surcharge added upon what is basically behavior-oriented, and it should probably be more a graduated source of income for the state.
Any questions? Thank you. And is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 2644 as amended? How are we? Well, any people want to be heard? Okay. Oh, did you want to comment on it? Okay. Well, we'll wait another minute or two.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, maybe it would be appropriate now to point out on the chart that I prepared, the figures are based on the fiscal notes from 2003 and 2005. We've got a new request in that should be done before we go before the Transportation Committee. I've talked to the Department of Finance. This total number of $107 million will go down a little bit, but not much. This is a thumbnail sketch, but a fairly accurate thumbnail sketch of what will be in front of the Transportation Committee on Tuesday.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nockwer. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, and I'd like to speak in support of this bill. Clearly, we appreciate Senator Ma and the committee protecting the Traumatic Brain Injury Fund. As you know, from 2003, when this bill came before, the original proposal came before this committee, it was because of the clear link between traffic crashes and brain injury and the clear link between drunk driving and traffic crashes. Over the last session, we worked closely with Senator Latz to try to get more people to reinstate by doing the payment plan. We worked real closely to try to make that happen. So, and our strong feeling is anything that we can do to get more people to reinstate is a good thing to do, so that there's more people legally driving on our highways, and anything that we can do, of course, to prevent future brain injuries is absolutely essential. We need to take care of folks, obviously, that already have a brain injury as a result of some of these crashes, but also prevent it. So we're glad to be in support of Senator Ma's bill. We feel it will help. And the efforts the Senator Latz did last year in the original bill. It will help more people reinstate. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Mwan. And I just also like to thank you for bringing this bill, because I think from my, just to say for the record, my support is certainly not to reward people who have committed these offenses, but the unintended consequence has been that we have too many people without insurance, and then there are victims as a result of that. And that's why one of the judges in my district specifically asked that we pay attention to this issue and try to reduce this fee if possible, so that we have more people with insurance. And so I was really happy to see you bringing this bill forward.
Well, any further to say?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm so sorry. I think at least three of us were in other meetings. Senator Olson and I are both. And so I haven't heard all of it. I'm just kind of looking at the language, and I'm wondering, are we just on page one, are we just taking out those 2002 and 2003 references? I noticed the original bill took them out.
It rolls back the fee increases that were made in 2003 in the court system mainly, which was used actually for the general fund.
Driver's license.
And Senator Moore's argument was that this has made it cost prohibitive for many people to access the court system.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you. I understand.
Okay. Well, maybe you can make a motion, and we'll see if we can where we're at by the time Senator Parasol gets here.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2644, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation, or the Committee on Finance, I guess.
Transportation is asked to see it next. It's a policy committee, and then
Transportation.
Okay. Is there discussion on the motion? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I certainly can sympathize with what Senator Moore is wanting to do, especially in the interest of justice, as well as she's very impassioned as she gave her discussion. I'm a little hesitant to make a recommendation to pass without having the full discussion in a finance committee. So I would like to amend the motion to I'm trying to understand what motion I wanted, but
move without recommendation.
Move without recommendation to a finance committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, as a policy committee, I would like us to not send it without recommendation. I think that if somebody's going to kill, I think as a policy committee, if we agree that if we could just suspend the hold on the general fund for the time being. And if on the policy side, we are in agreement that the fees are too excessive. And, you know, I didn't ask any of these people today to come and testify. I mean, I was willing to go solo on my own on this, because I know that from the work that we've done in this committee, that we all feel very strongly about how excessive some of these fines and fees are. And so I would ask that we do send it forward with a recommendation, but that if somebody is going to object to this proposal because of the money piece, then I would like that to be from the finance committees, saying that it's going to cost them too much money, because I want a very clear policy message to them. And if somebody's going to object to this, then let the money people object to it, because then I want them to be in a position to come back to us to say, well, then make sure that the money that's going into the general fund, we make sure that at some point we get a commitment to address the excessive fee issue, because certainly we're not getting the money back in terms of supporting the systems that's in the judiciary. So I would prefer that we send a very clean and clear message to them, and if anybody's going to object, I guess I would rather have the finance people say no to us on this proposal.
Senator Limmer, are you making the motion to amend?
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay. Then we have the motion by Senator Moore before us that Senate File 2644 be recommended to pass.
and be referred to the Committee on Transportation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you. And
Thank you, members.
We are in recess until 1 p.m., and then we will resume in room 118 at 1 p.m. We are in recess.
They're going to be in a-